Society Roundtable. I'm Christina.
I'm Abe.
Welcome, Abe. Thanks for joining us today. So we created this series to have discussions about art song, and we have brought in some very special guests from throughout the world of art song to aid us in our discussion today. Abe, will you introduce our special guests?
I certainly will. Joining us tonight is international opera star, bass baritone, Zachary James. Hi, Zach.
Hello.
Joining us from Connecticut is America's most prolific art song writer, composer, Juliana Hall. Hello, Juliana.
Hello. Hi.
And from the Down Under, the prolific, the talented, the sensational, the effervescent, the convivial, Caitlin Vincent.
Hey, everyone.
So the reason we brought the three of you here together is because you are currently collaborating on an art song project. Can you guys talk to us about that?
Sure. I think, Juliana, you should take it away.
I was just going to say, I was so happy because I had just seen Zach in Akhenaten, and it was just so incredible. The performance was fabulous. And I thought, oh my goodness, wouldn't it be wonderful to work with him? And so I got up the courage and I thought, I'm going to send him some music. So I sent him a new baritone piece, an old one, actually, but one of my very favorites. It's a piece on the poetry of W.H. Auden, and some of my favorites. And he wrote back so quickly, and I was just so thrilled, and I was just so happy to hear. So Zach and I kind of connected through Facebook, and but it was the Philip Glass that was so sensational. It was just an amazing performance. And so I was like, oh, please. So it worked. And then, Zach, you were asking me about staging that piece, right? And I thought I had never done that before. But I thought, wow, that would be really cool. And so we left it there for a while, right? It was just kind of
bouncing around.
Sorry.
And then I planned a Carnegie Hall recital for the fall and asked Juliana if I could use some of her work. And she said, well, can I write you a world premiere? And I, of course, said, yes. That'd be amazing.
No. Zach, for our audience that may not know, a Carnegie Hall is where?
It's this tiny venue in New York.
Never heard of it.
Yeah.
Don't worry, Zach. Things will pick up for you.
Yes.
I want to drop a bookmark in this idea of staged art song because it's something that we talked a little bit about last week. But okay, let's continue your collaboration and let's come back to that bookmark later.
All right, let's pick up where we left off. Librettist, yes.
Yes. So this collaboration started with Juliana. You were reaching out to Zachary, talking about a world premiere. And then how did Caitlin get brought into this circle?
Caitlin has been one of my very, very favorite writers, authors to work with. Her writing is so imaginative and fresh and beautiful and energetic. And I just have loved the two settings, the two pieces that we did together. So I was thinking, wow, I wonder if she would do this one more time. So,
and I said, yes. I said, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Anything you want.
And it was so wonderful because I was just so thrilled to have her thinking about the, you know, working with her words again, because they have given me such an amazing amount of sound color to work with and all kinds of emotion. And she really brings the characters to life, which is what I thought was so perfect about this next character that we were going to do, which is Ahab. And it was funny because I was wondering, what am I going to do for Zach? I thought, what character? Because Zach was so dramatic and he had such a dark, beautiful voice and resonant and deep. And I thought, oh, what character should he play? And I was going through days and days of thinking this. And you know how sometimes when you're asleep and you've been thinking about things and then all of a sudden an idea comes to mind? I woke up around 3 and Ahab just like, wow, yes, that guy who is kind of crazy and kind of obsessed with Moby Dick, he would Zach would be really cool with that guy. So then I asked Caitlin about that, and she went with, and I was shaking in my boots because I wanted to do it so badly. And I was saying, oh, Caitlin, oh, Zach, well, does it sound good to you guys? And so that's how we connected with Ahab in our midst.
Now, Julie, when you have those types of moments, does your husband and me also wake up and just with a pen and paper write it down and then you just fall back asleep?
No, but you know what? He happened to be awake and I said, it's Ahab. And he said, that's it. You know, I don't know if I woke him up from my exuberance or, you know, I was just so thrilled. And I haven't had one of those nighttime moments for a while, so it really surprised me. Wow. But I think it was Zach's dramatic and dark and rich sound in his voice that kind of gave me that character of really deep madness and theatrical and a lot of fun to write.
So Zach, when Juliana proposed that to you, how did that make you feel? And what do you look for when you're commissioning a work for yourself?
Yeah, for me, it was an instant yes. And very interestingly, so I should step back a bit and explain that this recital is an entire program devoted to the works of the female voice. So it's all female composers, which is something that's very important to me.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you know, so I ran Opera Ithaca for a number of years. I started and ran it and also ran a group in New York called Metropolis Opera Project. And it was a big thing that we were doing was producing works written by women. And we're, you know, that's back from like 2007. And now it's like suddenly in vogue and every company's like, oh God, we need a work written by a woman for a grant. And it's like, or
well,
because we're amazing writers.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But so this recital, that's what I wanted to do when I got this time and space at Carnegie. I wanted to do an entire evening of works devoted to primarily female composers. And I just happened to know a lot of amazing women that I already love to work with. And now to have Juliana and Caitlin in the mix is like very touching. So flash forward, interestingly enough, there are two other works in this program, which are premieres, or works in progress that are based on great works of literature, one being The Raven and the other being The Old Man and the Sea. So the last three numbers on the program will be those three from Moby Dick, The Raven, and Old Man and the Sea, which I think is a pretty cool way to wrap the evening.
It just seems like this whole recital came together because you were planning one around women and you had this wonderful woman approach you and say, can I write something for you? And all of them just magically happen to have this through theme. I love it. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really cool. And a lot of the people that I'm working with on this recital, the other musicians and some of the other composers I've been working with for many, many years. So it's really, I've always loved this idea of gathering your very favorite artists and friends and people and creating something together. That's to me the most intoxicating, magical part of art making. And so to have this opportunity to create with people that I really love and respect is very exciting. And Juliana and Caitlin being the newest additions to the group. So it's pretty cool.
It's very in the spirit of Art Song Salon.
Yeah.
Indeed. Now Caitlin, how is it? Speaking of small world, we're able to do this virtually. And how is it collaborating with an art form that is so intimate? How does one transcend that living thousands of miles away in a land down under?
Yeah, well, you know, it's really all about Skype and Zoom, you know. So I've been here about 5 years, and I've worked with a number of composers on a number of projects, and in many cases, I've never actually met them in person. Even Juliana, we've never actually met in person, only through the computer. But you know, it would be very different if this were the 19th century and we were writing letters, and I was saying, "What do you think of this term?" But you know, in the world of texting and WhatsApp and Facebook, I can just, you know, message Juliana and say, "Oh, I had this idea. What do you think of this phrase?" You know, so it actually really promotes really active collaboration, and perhaps even more so if we lived in the same city, because I don't have to wait to set up a time for coffee. But it's very different. But I feel very fortunate that I've been able to have such great collaborations using this virtual platform, and that I can still be very connected to the American scene and all of my favorite American composers and singers in this way.
Juliana, do you find it, or I guess let me phrase that differently. how do you approach things working with a librettist versus working with a poem that's already out there? Like, how do you find that collaborative process? Do you feel like you have an influence on the words?
Actually, with Caitlin, I just really believe in her words. I don't even touch them. I just think that they're so sensational that she, every time, I mean, this is our third time, so I feel like she's really given me something very, very great already to work with. You know, I've never been much of a poet or a, you know, some composers can write their own lyrics and that sort of thing. But for me, it's just the music. So I really, you know, once I get a nice, wonderful librettist like Caitlin, I just feel like it's her show for the words, and then I'll take it as the for the music. But there's one thing that is really neat about a libretto versus a poem, and the libretto, since it's a little bit more freestanding in the structure. I mean, I have little, where she has little dots, and I can make some nice music and transition, you know, kind of music from one scene to another. I mean, in her Ahab, he's really feeling so much emotion and so much rage and then warmth and but all in one piece. So Caitlin has given me time to go from here to there to there. So in a sense, the libretto kind of gives me, is a little bit of a freer form, where a poem is a very structured kind of piece. Mm-hmm.
And
so
Caitlin,
Zach, I'm sorry, I'm stepping on, I'm taking over this interview. Thanks for stopping by, Dina.
I just wanted to take that question and reverse it and ask Caitlin, because you're a singer as well. So do you feel that being a singer reflects how you write for a libretto?
I think, you know, when I started writing, it was initially because I wanted to write different kinds of characters for myself than sort of the Fock that I was in, which is, you know, the Ina Etta, never get to die on stage. So I was really wanting to be able to sing different kinds of characters. And so I just started writing them because I hadn't found them yet. So that's really how I came to writing. And I started with opera and then also art song, which is essentially a practice session for opera. It's a chance to do a really delicate mini narrative or mini character portrait. But with me, I know that it's, you know, a song or an opera, it's about the combination of the two. That's what elevates it. You know, my words on their own it's an incomplete work. So I try and do my best to structure a piece around how I think it might flow. And that depends on, you know, whether it's a comic piece or whether I decide to use rhyme schemes. In the case of Ahab, it's very much sort of a stream of consciousness, mental collapse, because, you know, Ahab's a little... but so in that case, I had some ideas that I said, oh, this is probably a different scene. And so I notate that for Juliana. And then we have a chance to talk about it. And I know that, you know, in many cases, the text won't be done. The version that I sent Juliana won't necessarily be the final version. And this is where the collaboration gets so amazing because it elevates it together.
So at what point do you consult Zach? Or do you... But when does he get to weigh in?
I guess so I received a libretto.
Yes.
And it was amazing.
Exactly. That was like the fifth version. Juliana messaged me and said, how about Ahab? And I said, sure, no problem. I'll just take Moby Dick and put it into an 8-minute song. That seems fine.
You just cut out the first half, which is like a wailing manual.
Yeah,
anyway. Exactly.
So I did a lot of research. I did a lot of reading. And then I, you know, did the outline. I this whole time I'm talking to Juliana, this is what I'm thinking. This is my approach. And then I start to write, and then I write several drafts. So I don't really want Zach to see the early drafts because you don't want to see how the sausage is being made. So the version that he has, which is sort of the final version that Juliana would potentially start to set, that's around draft 5. And so that's the one that you have, which is fairly polished. And then at that point, any feedback from him, I mean, we were kind of just hoping he wouldn't hate it. So I think we've already done well with that.
No, Zach, did you say, could you make him a little more insane?
Well, it was proposed to me as a mad scene, which is really all I ever want to do anyway. So I was happy. was pleased from the beginning.
That's so my happy place. Yeah. You're no stranger to doing new works, it seems. You've premiered several roles. Have you ever had a chance to weigh in and say, like, you know, this doesn't quite fit my voice? Can we tweak things here or there? Can we put a different vowel
it's
on
not
this pitch?
Quite sane enough for me.
Yeah. You know, all the time, my first major premiere was a Glass opera. And, you know, we got it by email and then sang it for him on the first day of rehearsal. And, you know, he just said, okay, great. So it was very easy. My next big project was Breaking the Waves with Missy Mazzoli and Royce Vavrick. And for that, we did 2 years of workshops here in Philadelphia. So in that process, it wasn't so much the singer saying, like, this doesn't work, what about this? It was the writers presenting something new each day with rewrites and hearing what we were capable of. There was one day Missy said, you know, if you were just going to scream out because you saw an accident about to happen, a life-threatening accident, what would you do? Can you just do that as an actor right now? And I screamed, and it was like this high A-flat belted scream. And it wasn't something, if I saw on paper, I would be terrified because I don't sing that note. But because it was just coming from an emotional place as an actor, she was like, yeah, that's it. And then wrote it down. You know, it's like those cool moments.
Zach, I completely understand. That's the natural pitch of my scream, actually.
Perfect. That's it.
So, we all have them. This actually might be a really good place to transition into our first audio clip, which is actually a role that you premiered, Zach. This is from The Old Man and the Sea by Paolo Prestini, and the role is Santiago. Can you tell us a little bit to set up this audio clip?
Sure. So this is actually yet to premiere. It's a work that's been in development since 2017. A really beautiful collaboration with Paolo Prestini and again Royce Vavrick. This is another mad scene. It's Santiago's mad scene at sea. And so he is several characters. He's himself, and he's the boy who's calling to him from shore, and he's also the environment, the ocean. It's a really heart-wrenching moment. So this is an opera that we hope to premiere in the next couple of years. There's an international premiere planned, which I'm really excited about. Really, really lovely. This recording is from Carnegie Hall last January for Renee Fleming's Song Studio.
I have tried to write paradise to not move. Let the wind speak. That is paradise. Let God forgive what I have made. Let those I love try to forgive what I have made.
What a fun piece. I want to use that to ask you, what is your approach to learning something new? There's really nothing out there to inform how you create this. So what's your approach?
text, then rhythm, then notes, and just, you know, it's like that particular piece. And so that's just like the first minute and a half of a 10-minute thing. If any listeners are interested, it's on my website. It's that piece I learned while driving from Manhattan to Long Island in one day, because I received an email from Royce Vavrick, and he said, hey, what are you doing? Can you come to Long Island tomorrow? Paolo Prassini and I are at Robert Wilson's, you know, arts compound, and we need a singer. And
you're like, I don't think so.
It's like, I'll be there tomorrow, you know? And then the next morning I got sent this piece of music. All I knew was I was showing up, you know, 3 hours later and singing for Robert Wilson. So I just learned it while in the car, you know? So a lot of times you just like don't have time to think about process and you just do it, you know? And thankfully, I don't know, when I've been in those kind of crisis emergency learning music moments, my body just does it. And but then if I have 3 months to learn a role, it takes all 3 months. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's good to have that kind of crisis response as a singer.
Yes.
Do you prepare for new roles differently than you prepare for more established roles, would you say?
I sure do prefer a new role. I mean, it really helps me to not have to listen to other singers and compare myself to their assets. I would say, you know, it's, I started in musical theater. My career began on Broadway, and I kind of fell into opera actually because of Philip Glass. And I just started doing opera full time, but I was just doing contemporary opera. And then my agent said, like, you really have to diversify and start doing traditional work. So we started doing like Wagner and Verdi and everything, and it was fine and nice to know I could do it. But my heart is so much in new music and creating something new and something that means something to today's audience. Like I did a production at Nabucco a couple of years ago, and it was exciting to bring that score to life, but it was like, why are we telling this pointless story? Who cares? You know, it was just not, it didn't mean anything to me in the way that producing and creating something new means so much.
Well, certainly, you know, it's difficult for one's heart to lurch back and forth with that.
You did there, Abe.
I understand that you originated the role of Lurch on Broadway. Is that true?
I did. Yeah, that's true. And that's actually how I ended up in opera, though, which is really a strange thing that happened. Was the director of the Addams Family on Broadway was Phelan McDermott, who I just did Akhenaten with, you know, four times, and who brought me into opera by pulling me into this Glass premiere called The Perfect American. So it's really by playing, you know, cartoon zombie on Broadway that I am now in opera.
Singing Verdi and Wagner. That is not the usual track.
Very strange.
Would you consider yourself a crossover artist then?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of opera singers ask me like, oh, you were on Broadway. How can I do it too? You know, tell me the secrets. And I always preface that by saying like, it's officially now been 10 years since I left Broadway, and I was on Broadway for 5 years, did a few different shows. But I feel like my knowledge is not current because it's been a decade. So while I do musicals still, they're oftentimes with, like I did West Side Story a couple times last year with big symphony orchestras, and I've done Sweeney Todd with opera companies. And so I'm not really doing musical theater in that sense that I'm doing it with theater companies or on Broadway. I'm doing it occasionally and with big classical music organizations. So in a way, I'm like not really a crossover artist.
Do you find that back and forth, that lurching is just too hard on your heart?
No, it's cool. You know, my voice teacher, who I've been with for 17 years, her voice teacher did a bunch of fest contracts and talked about how important it was to sing Butterfly one night and, you know, Elvira the next night, and just to remain really versatile and flexible. And that is the biggest thing my voice teacher has said forever, is like, you must be versatile and flexible. And your voice, you have one voice and it has many colors and you could do many things with it, but it's just that one voice.
Yeah.
So that leads me to my next question, which is, do you feel that your skill set in Broadway is different than your skill set in opera, or do you think that they're the same?
I think they lend a hand to each other. I am always really grateful that my roots are in acting and movement and dance, because to me, the acting part of it is so gratifying, and physically inhabiting a role is always where I start when building a character. But, you know, I missed out on a lot of traditional opera training. And then with the trends of musical theater currently, towards the end of my time full time in musical theater, when I was going in for auditions, the casting director would say, like, great, can you do that again? But just don't sing it at all. Just speak it, you know. And I would start and they'd be like, no singing at all. And, you know, so
is that why you brought Doc Naughton?
Yes. I don't know. No, Phelim was just, you know, we're really used to working with each other because we've been working together since 2008 now and have done so many shows together. So I know his vocabulary and the way he stages and builds shows and characters. And that was actually a very last minute cast. I was called by English National Opera a week before the first day of rehearsal and asked if I would do Akhenaten. And I flew to London.
And you're like,
I don't know. Yeah. But they handed me a script on the first day of rehearsal. So that was another, like, learn an enormous thing overnight moment. When I showed up for that Akhenaten, the first process, I really had very little experience speaking on stage. So it's kind of interesting because it's basically like doing Shakespearean soliloquies all night long, you know, full body.
Tell
experience.
Me about it. It's the worst.
It's fun. But not something I was experienced in, you know, really stretched me.
No,
you're in charge. I'll just sit here.
So you were saying that you approach things from a physical standpoint, from you know, movement, and how does that translate into art song then? Do you have to approach it from a completely different way?
Character? My big secret is I don't have a lot of experience in art song, just because I didn't go through the conservatory route, and I've actually never done a recital ever.
This is my first recital.
I'm sorry that I'm such a small venue. I can't get you a better venue.
Juliana, was that a look of worry on your face that this is first recital? Okay.
I'm certainly not. I mean, I've done a lot of things like this, but I've always called them like cabarets or one-man shows, because whenever I do something on stage, it's like fully staged and fleshed out and has a story. And so there's a director who's working on this recital, Ellen Jackson, who's brilliant, and it will be fully staged. We're just kind of calling it a recital to shake it up a bit and break the form. And I like this idea of doing like a fully staged kind of semi-costumed, you know, strange recital of all new music at Carnegie Hall, which is not used to seeing such things.
And for audiences that don't know what Carnegie Hall is, could you explain that once again? They're just tuning in.
It's just a very small venue on 57th Street in New York.
Don't worry, things will pick up for you.
So, as I was saying, that brings us to our bookmark, which is staged art song, which is kind of a hot button issue in the world of art song. How do we all feel about that?
I'm in favor. I mean, okay, so I did the conservatory track, right? And, you know, you're hanging on, you do a recital, you're hanging on to the piano for dear life, singing your Mahler or your Schubert. It's not the best way to connect with an audience, right? And the amazing thing about recitals is it's such an intimate setting. You know, you go back to the origins, it was someone's living room. And so I think that we can take advantage of that. And this idea of really inhabiting a character in this art song setting, in this intimate space, and really connecting with the audience. I mean, why not take it a step further and actually, you know, stage it a bit, have costumes, and have each song or song set as essentially a mini character portrait. So I'm fully expecting a harpoon and a scar and a peg leg for Ahab Jack. So I'm just going to go ahead and put that there. I don't know. What do you think, Juliana?
Oh, go for it. Yeah, I think it'd be really, really cool.
Have you ever had any of your pieces staged before?
No, although one time a girl was a soprano was doing a letter of Emily Dickinson, and she was pretending that she was writing. I think that's as close as I've gotten. And there's another cycle, A World Turned Upside Down, which are the journal of Anne Frank, and or the diary of Anne Frank, and they're so intimate, and she's so herself. You know, I almost felt like the singer was acting it and being this girl, Anne Frank, although it wasn't really staged or anything, but I could see that would be really neat, and I'd love to see that sometime. And so Zach, even that one you were talking about, Death's Echo, could, you know, I think it'd be really, brings it to another level of, brings it close to the audience.
Yeah. So that's where I'll, I think, sorry, I was just
sorry,
say,
Zach. No, you know what? I'm just going to mute my audio. I'll just watch.
I was just going to say, just to clarify what I mean by staging, I don't necessarily mean like, you know, tearing down the wall, but just inhabiting character fully. And and mostly to connect with the audience. And, you know, staging can be just standing and doing very little, but connecting with the audience in a genuine way that brings them into the world of the piece.
Do you feel that by way of libretto is enhances that experience or makes it more approachable than poetry?
I think so. And I'm certainly doing some pieces based on poetry on the program. But I love this word monodrama that Juliana is using to describe the piece because it sets up what it's going to be. And I think, yeah, a monodrama. It's basically, it's an 8-minute opera, right? I mean, which is kind of really cool.
You know, that's a really good word, I think, too. And I was thinking when we did Godiva together, I had this sense that I was almost writing an opera, a mini opera. I mean, because I could see that she could, you know, really connect with the audience and really act, be Godiva, be the character. Mm. And that's what I'm thinking about Ahab. So,
yeah,
I think that's a good feel, a good way of thinking about it.
I really need to stop acting as Godiva day to day. It's getting in the way of things.
Thanks for your input, Abe.
I'll mute my audio again.
So for me as a librettist, you know, I am very drawn to characters, and that's what I write. So even when I write in comedy or sort of really short pieces that aren't as operatic, it's still very character driven. And it's about inhabiting that character, whether she's, you know, a millennial version of a Greek myth or Lady Godiva or Ahab or just sort of your average 30 something going to a coffee shop. But I know that there are many very talented poets and librettists active right now who don't, that's not their preferred style. That's completely, you know, that's an amazing way to write. You know, it's really about the language and about the rhythm. So that creates a very different type of recital concert experience. It's just for me, I'm all about the characters. So I think that if you wanted me to write just something about the falling leaves, it would be absolutely terrible. But if you wanted me to write about someone raking the leaves, it would be fantastic.
That's already been done. It's called The Rake's Progress.
Yes.
But you know, to speak to just briefly about the scope of an 8-minute monodrama or a series of art song, our friend Dr. Susan Ewens, one of the foremost leading experts on German song, writes, songs may be small in terms of real estate when compared to the Texas-sized genres of opera and symphony, but they strike deep. All right. So, good night, everyone.
When this is a podcast, nobody's actually going to be able to see that, but we all just nodded our heads in unison. Yeah. I don't think we can argue with that. So we've heard a piece from Zach, and now I would like to hear a piece from Juliana. And we picked a piece based on a poem by Emily Dickinson, "Lightly Stepped a Yellow Star." And Juliana, I don't want you to say anything about it first. I want to read the poem, and I want people to imagine the aural world that they can from this poem, and then I want to play your version of it. Okay. So Lightly Stepped a Yellow Star by Emily Dickinson. Lightly stepped a yellow star to its lofty place, loosed the moon her silver hat from her lustral face, all of evening softly lit as an astral hall. Father, I observed to heaven, you are punctual. And this is a performance by the fabulous Nadine Benjamin with Nicole Panizza at the piano.
Lightly stepped a yellow star to its lofty place, loosed the moon, silver hat from her lustral face, all of evening softly lit as an astral hall. Father, I observed to heaven, you are punctual.
I love that piece so much. That's why I picked it.
I was wondering how that came about, why you would choose that one. It's such a funny little piece.
Yes, and the reason I read the poem is because reading that poem, that is not the harmonic language I would have expected, or not necessarily, just the setting. I've heard other settings, especially choral ones of that one, and it's always like a lovely, lush, twinkling star, and that is not your approach to it at all. So can you tell us, with this piece in particular, but then in general, how you approach text setting?
Well, this piece, I think I was thinking of little stars bouncing around and stepping and dancing, kind of. And with the the moon lustral face, and that was a really delicate, kind of a warm place. But I think I was thinking of it as a very playful starlight. And then in the soft moonlight, you know, the accompaniment changes, or in the soft evening, yeah, the accompaniment changes into a quieter little piece. But I think all of it is a little bit of a fun, just playful. You know, this is the second song in a set of five. It's called In Reverence, and it's about seeing spiritual and heavenly things in the things that Emily Dickinson does talk about a lot. So I thought I'd write about them, but sometimes she's a little bit, she has her sense of humor in things. And I'm not saying that that was a humorous one, but you can play with it a little bit if you want to. But I was seeing the little lights of the stars, you know, I was enjoying that. And that's a very early piece. And I think also I was kind of trying to find my voice too, to match Emily. You know, it was like, that was the first piece that I had done at Yale, and I just started writing at Yale. So, you know, it was very early. I was 26, and somebody suggested Emily Dickinson to me. And I thought, okay, you know, I'll see what she writes about. And so she writes about a lot about spiritual things. And then thinking of the just a little brightness and the almost a little bit of atonality and jumping around in the harmonies a little bit. I think I was trying to find where I belonged in the writer's world. So,
now, Julie, for those of us that don't know, Yale is...
Oh, it's just this little country town, you know, university type thing. One of those.
No. Can you talk about your experience as a composer and your development from
Yale, which I'm sorry, I don't know the name, to when you studied with Dominic Argento?
Oh, well, I started at Yale, and, you know, I started as a pianist because that's really the only way I could get in. That's the only thing I could do. And I wanted to go to Yale because I wanted to see, like, well, where do you belong in this world? You know what I mean? Everybody needs a place. And so I knew piano. I wasn't really a pianist. So I went to Yale, and I started writing songs, and they said, Martin Bresnik, the head of the department, said, you know, you should really be studying composition. You're a composer. So I went and I studied only 2 years because it was just a master's. So I didn't have enough time to develop much. You know, I wrote and wrote and wrote. And I think I did 4 or 5 song cycles. And I knew that that felt right. You know, like that's a good place for me to be. So I knew that they had helped me find that little spot that everybody kind of needs to find for themselves. But then I didn't know what to do after that. And they suggested Dominic Argento. So I wrote to him and I asked if I could be a part of the doctoral program there. So I can study with him. And I'm not an academic at all. And I'm sure he was like, what have I done? Oh, my goodness, get this girl out of here. She can't hardly write a paper. I mean, you know, here I was trying to do doctoral work and all that kind of thing. But, you know, I actually spent the time writing and he didn't mind it too much. But I wrote and wrote and he was very supportive and just... he was a phenomenal person for me because he had such a sense of what made singers feel good, you know, in their voice and how the text felt and how you could help them. He would always say, let the singer sing, you know, so he would give me, you know, that sense that the singer really likes to use their voice and enjoy it. So things like that. And then text, he knew a lot of literature. He was just really super at that sort of thing. So, you know, I really, from Yale to Dominic, I was really led by the composers at Yale to get to Dominic. Because, you know, you come from a little town, you don't really have a sense of what's out there. But with all the help of these really neat guys, they showed me, you know, they gave me good direction.
Now, Caitlin, speaking of text serving the voice or vice versa, how does that, when you're writing the text for these libretti, are you thinking about how a singer may, the challenges they may face singing a certain word, and do you change the words based upon that?
I'm certainly aware of it. You know, until the text has been set to music, I can't say for sure, oh, I've given them a horrible vowel to sing on this particular note. So, and, you know, Juliana is so great at text setting that that's never happened where I said, oh, actually, I'm not sure you want to give the ooh vowel on the high B. I do, you know, when it comes to writing text, writing libretto, it's very different from writing plays or just talking normally. You know, everything's slowed down. And in terms of song, it's really about audience comprehension, right? So I'm all about having kind of simple, short sentences, phrases that are broken up, not a whole paragraph where they can get lost. So I'm thinking about simplicity. And one of my main mentors has been Mark Campbell, who's, you know, kind of at the forefront of contemporary opera. And so he's given me lots of guidance. And I was very lucky to work with him very early in my career. So he's shaped me in a lot of ways. But it's simplicity of language. If you can say a sentence in 5 words, why would you use 10? And then also using evocative language that will help to inspire the composer and give a sense of the emotion that you're trying to project. And then, of course, character for me. So with Ahab, you know, I decided early on I didn't want Ahab to actually be set during the book, right? But at the end, he has a very, sorry, this is a spoiler for anyone who hasn't read Moby Dick. It's a very unsatisfying end.
Don't worry, we can take this out in post-production.
Okay. He throws the harpoon. The rope gets caught around his neck and he gets just pulled under and he just doesn't appear again. And that's it. And you're like, I read these 500 pages, and that's it.
Plus a whaling manual.
So for me, I really wanted
to see
epilogue.
And also, you just ruined it for me.
I'm sorry, he died. Did I say he died? But so then that was the character, this idea of what would actually happen afterwards? What would happen when he's suspended underground? You know, how can we channel that character and his voice in this 8 minutes? So that's kind of a general sense of the process. So simplicity, character, the voice, I kind of hear them, you know, Ahab scowling in my head.
Now, does your background as a trained singer inform your decisions, or how do you compartmentalize that? Do you, I'm sorry, if I wasn't supposed to say you're a trained singer, I can edit that out.
No, it's fine. I am. I think that being a singer helps me in terms of rhythm. You know, it's this idea of what is the flow of a sentence? You know, how does it sound? How do the words work together? And that's something from my singing experience. And then also this idea of character and how could someone interpret this on stage? You know, what's going to be the most powerful. So that connection to character and looking for kinds of texts that I know would have spoken to me as a singer, I think helps. So it really does. I can't really separate the two parts for me, which I think it is nice. And so I think that the text is nice for singers to sing. I'm singers like to sing the text because I have that singer connection. And then I can also, you know, yell at the composer if they said it in a really uncomfortable way.
So both you, Julie, and Caitlin, your songs are widely recognized for their ease of singing, is in that it's natural. Zach, how have you found that? Is that something that you, how does that vary from composer to composer, and in commissioning a new work, was that a defining factor for you?
You know, I just like to look at what writers have put on paper and look for the clues. And, you know, if there's ever a challenging moment that I can't get through, I don't necessarily think it needs to be changed. It's on me to figure out how to make it work. And that's coming from like training as an actor. Like that's what my degree is really in. So, you know, and our job is to make whatever is on paper work. So I like to apply that to music as well. And, you know, also coming from musical theater, we're not put in these boxes of FOC. And so it didn't really matter what I called myself in that world. It's more like, do you look the part and can you sing it? And a lot of times that means that you're going in for a rock tenor audition, and you might not call yourself that, but that day, that's what you're going to be for whoever
and
is
so,
behind the table.
So based on that, so, yep, they cast you as Lurch.
Well, yeah, but that's a role that was written for me, you know? And oh, so Andrew Lippa wrote that for me. And he actually spoofed Verdi randomly. I like can't get away from opera no matter what I'm doing. You know, but yeah, musical theater is just, it's a very different thing. It's more like, do you look the part and can you sing it? That's been an interesting thing about the classical music world where, you know, for years people were like, well, you're not a bass, you're a bass baritone, or are you a bass? And I'm like, who cares? Does anyone care at all? Like, you know, my manager finally convinced me that I have to call myself a bass baritone going forward, because I had been referring to myself as a bass for a couple of years, but I still cannot understand why it even matters. You know, let's just tell stories and sing.
Do you ever just say, look, I originated the role of Lurch, so screw you?
I try not to be like
that. I would say that all the time.
You can get away with things I can't, I think. But I should say, I did sing, actually, the few art songs I've sung, a few of them were actually these glorious Gustav Holst songs. And some of them, I guess, were supposedly written for a tenor, but I sing them and just, you know, use my falsetto. And it's some of my favorite things to sing. But when I presented that in a recital as a young artist at Central City, and everyone just lost their mind. And they were like, you can't sing this literature. And I was like, but I just did, and it was good. And so, you know, like, I just don't understand why we have to put these boxes around ourselves. And I think that's a wonderful trend that's happening with new opera and, you know, just classical vocal music in general, is that we're allowed to go to these far reaches now and really push out, which I think is really important.
So, you know, it's just no fun to lurch back and forth.
You were working on Edward Tulane, the Paola Prestini premiere at Minnesota Opera, and having done the workshops for that, you go into it not really knowing what the voice types are for the characters in there. You kind of look at the range and you say, all right, I think maybe this voice, and that's kind of what the workshopping process is for. So Juliana, when you're composing, do you say, I'm going to write this piece for soprano, or I'm going to write this piece for a tenor, or do you just write a piece and then the voices that are comfortable in it perform it?
I actually know exactly what kind of voice type I'm thinking about, you know, because I choose the poetry based on the voice also, you know, like sometimes like Anne Frank, you know, I thought, she was a little different. I thought of her as a young girl, as maybe a mezzo, but it turned out that it was very nice as a soprano piece. So I tried to think of the voices with the text, you know, like Ahab, you know, is a really nice, deep, dark voice. And so I think for me, the text will lend itself to a certain sound in the voice. I mean, in the singer. So it, I like, let's see, the Kitty Whately piece with Godiva. It was a nice mezzo piece, but also a high mezzo. So she could, you know, do some different things that Godiva might do. So I think there's always a sense that, it's nice to have the singers in my mind as I'm working with the piece. So.
Mm-hmm. So I have one final question, and I'm going to pose it to all of you and answer as you will, if you will. Why art song?
It's a wonderful world. It's a beautiful world. It's very tiny and it's very intimate, and it shows you much about human nature and life in general. The poets, they know how to speak. They teach, or they can teach you, or if you read them long enough, you can understand a lot more about where we are and what's going on in the world, because they shed a light that's different than just the ordinary eye. Okay.
All right, who wants to follow that?
I'll go. We'll leave Zach to end it. It's about the character portrait and this idea of getting to have these tiny little jewels. I like to think about it as sort of the best dinner party ever. A good recital is the best dinner party, and it's these tiny little dishes that are served, and they take you on a journey. And that's something we can do in opera to some extent, but it's a different experience. It's more intimate, and you get to have these varied tiny little dishes, these little bites of things. And so I'm really fond of art song, and I loved singing it. And I went to Songfest for a few years, and so that really whetted my appetite for song. So I just love getting to work with Juliana and Zach and other composers on those, as well as opera. It wouldn't be the same just to do opera.
All right, who wants to follow that?
Well, I was going to use a similar metaphor to the dinner party, but in that, like taking a vacation to the most fabulous place, and you know, you can't live there, but it's so wonderful to go visit it. And that art song is a small, beautiful, delicate, you know, morsel. It's so intimate and vulnerable. And there's something really virtuosic about vulnerability and intimacy that you can't always get in opera. And I think, you know, that's starting to change, especially with the advent of chamber opera becoming such a big part of the contemporary opera scene. For me, it's really intimacy and vulnerability. And those two qualities, I think, make the most special art. And you can have intimacy and vulnerability with a 100-piece orchestra on a stage with 5,000, you know, in the audience. But I think that's hard to achieve.
So if people want to find out about your recital and how they can get tickets, where should they go?
Yeah, tickets will be on sale in September on the Carnegie Hall website. And there's more info on that website.
If you're just tuning in.
Abe's goal is to get as many eye rolls as possible during one of these.
If you would explain what Carnegie Hall is to those just tuning in.
Yeah, it's a little kind of Rag and Bones venue on 57th Street.
Well, Zach, hopefully this by appearing on our program today, it really helps jumpstart your career.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
If folks want to know more about all of you, where can they go?
Websites. CaitlinVincent.com is my website. Juliana's frozen, but she also has a website. And her music is published through Shermer.
Zach, you have a website?
She's frozen in a really unfortunate...
sort of like Martha Graham moment.
Was it like an 80s music video? Yeah.
I can be found at zachjames.com and on all social platforms, Zachary James. And I'm really excited about this Carnegie Hall recital and all the wonderful artists I'm collaborating with. So thank you for letting us talk about this.
Don't worry, Zach, for those of us who's just tuning in, I'll let people know what Carnegie Hall is so you don't have to explain it again.
Thank you, everyone, for being here.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for having us.
If you want to know more about the LEAD Society, you can check out our website at leadsociety.org. You can follow us on Facebook. We are also on Instagram at LEAD Society. Anything else to add there, Abe?
No, I'll be telling everyone what Carnegie Hall is.
So we'll be back with another one of these next week. Abe, do you want to tell everyone who our special guests are next week?
Yes, next week, live from San Francisco, is another composer, Kurt Erickson, who's the composer and residence at Leader Alive in San Francisco, and his beautiful wife, the soprano Heidi Moss, will be joining us.
Awesome. Until next week, thanks for tuning in.
Good night.
Good night.